Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today at Heinz Convention Center. Governor Charlie Baker toured the mass vaccination site there just now with state health officials, members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. They had the head of FEMA and CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. The site's been named one of a handful of these large-scale federal vaccination partnerships. So this comes as Walensky is warning states of a possible fourth surge of coronavirus and asking governors to pause some reopening plans.
Right now, it's preventable. We know that it's preventable. We have the science to prevent. We know what we need to do to stop the surge, and we would ask everybody to go ahead and do that.
WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown is at Heinz, joins us now. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So we were listening for it, Steve. Did Dr. Walensky say anything specific about the Massachusetts reopening plan today?
No, she was reluctant to call out anything about Massachusetts reopening plan or any state's plan for that matter. She said you just wouldn't get into the individual state's plans. She did praise the state for still having a mask mandate. She looked at all the reporters who were gathered in the room and said that she was glad to see that everyone there was wearing a mask. She would like everyone in the country to wear a mask, even in those states that have lifted the mask mandates.
So yesterday she made some waves by referring to, you know, feeling a sense of impending doom. Was there any indication from the governor that he's thinking about slowing reopening plans?
No, as he always does, the governor says that he follows the data. Now, that data has been showing that infections have been ticking up, but he points to two cases, a church on the Cape and a high school party in his hometown of Swampscott, as two reasons for the increase. Obviously not for all of the increase, but he points to those, which are kind of beyond his control. The state has seen a 15% increase in the average daily cases from March 19th to March 26th. The average number of infections have reached their highest point since mid-February. But nothing at this point from the governor indicating any reinstating those things. But that could always come depending on the data. And, you know, he's concerned about, what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. Passover this past weekend. Easter this weekend. He was talking about what happened at Thanksgiving time, and he's hoping that that doesn't happen again.
I know Dr. Walensky was slated to speak with at least some governors today, and with that in mind and with what you just said, I want to play a little bit of sound from today. At one point, Governor Baker ran through all the current restrictions on businesses. Here he is.
Businesses like restaurants and other indoor entertainment venues have reopened, but they all have sector-specific public health protocols that they must follow to keep customers safe. And between the folks at the ABCC and our colleagues in local government, there are many inspections constantly being put forth to make sure people are complying with the rules.
You had to wonder, Steve, who he was speaking to there. Do you think that was delivered for Walensky's benefit?
I think it may have been, although he has pointed out those restrictions before. Other states have lifted the restrictions, and I think the governor likes to draw a contrast, trying to show that we are reopening, but doing so prudently.
So let's talk about this mass vaccination site at Heinz. So it's going to be scaled up as part of this federal partnership. When does that scaling happen? How many shots will it be able to deliver a day, et cetera?
Sure. It's going to be up and running as of tomorrow. They're just getting set up here today. Although it has been operational as one of the MassVac sites. Remember, it was over at Fenway Park first. And as the Red Sox season's about to start, they moved operations over here to the Heinz. So that's been going on. But now tomorrow is going to be the big push when they're going to go from 1,000 shots a day, which they're giving here now, to 7,000 shots a day. That's 6,000 shots that's coming through that federal program. And that's going to make a big difference here.
How does it fit into the larger vaccination strategy?
I think they figure that every bit helps. It's here located specifically to help address some equity issues. The governor pointed out that the Heinz is close to the green and the orange lines and several bus routes. Part of this FEMA pilot program allows up to a third of the vaccine to be distributed via mobile vaccine clinics to places like Chelsea, Revere, and Boston. So it is adding every shot helps. They're going to take any vaccine they can get from any source, obviously, you know, the federal government or the state or the pharmacies, however they're going to get it, they're going to take it and hopefully get the bulk of the population vaccinated as soon as possible.
All right, WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown from the Heinz Convention Center. Steve, thanks.
Thanks, Diziana.
Today marks 1 year since news broke of the widespread deadly COVID-19 outbreak at the Holyoke Soldiers Home. Nearly 80 veterans died as a result of that outbreak. Now, WBUR's Miriam Wasser was one of the first reporters on that story and stayed on it as it unfolded. Today, we invited Miriam to look back on that heartbreaking story and what has happened since with us. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Miriam.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So Miriam, take us back to when the outbreak first happened. How did you learn about it?
Sure. So I was very new to covering this beat. As you know, I'm typically an environmental reporter, but had volunteered to start covering nursing homes and long-term care facilities as the pandemic began. And at the time, I remember I was just trying to keep an aggregated list of which long-term care facilities had outbreaks. That felt like something that would be possible to even do. And on Sunday, March 22nd, the Soldiers Home put out a press release and said it had one resident that tested positive and that this patient was isolated. So I added that to the story online. And the following day, I got an anonymous email from someone who said that they worked at the Soldiers Home. And this person was really upset and said that CDC health guidelines weren't being followed, that the leadership team was negligent, and that just the situation overall was a lot worse than anyone was letting on. So over the course of the next week or so, I continued corresponding with this person, and I just got more and more details. Like, they sent me a photo of the refrigerated truck that had to be brought in to deal with the excess of dead bodies that the morgue couldn't handle. And I was working on this story, trying to figure out what was happening, when on the evening of March 30th, so 1 year ago today, the state put out a kind of cryptic press release saying that the superintendent of the home, and this is the Bennett Walsh, a retired Marine, it said that he had been put on administrative leave. And a little while later, they confirmed that 11 residents had died and that more were sick. And that's how it all unfolded.
And then, Miriam, things happened pretty quickly. The state almost immediately launched an investigation into the outbreak. That resulted in a scathing 174-page report. Remind us what came out of that report.
Yeah, I think scathing is a very accurate term. So you're talking about the independent investigation that was done by attorney Mark Perlstein. And that report came out in June and concluded that, you know, while no single action caused the outbreak to be so bad, things did get so bad because of a series of chronic structural problems and also poor decision-making on the part of the facility's leadership team. So some of those chronic problems included things like short staffing, a lack of sufficient PPE, a very insular leadership team that was known to be like really vindictive, and a Department of Veteran Affairs that apparently knew about a lot of these problems but didn't do enough to fix them. And, you know, some of the bad decision-making included rotating staff across floors and not properly isolating sick residents. But by far the worst decision was the one on March 27th to combine two floors of dementia patients. So I know you and I have talked about this, but just to recap, you know, the leadership team said that with so many employees calling out sick, it had no choice but to consolidate two floors of residents. And this move mixed veterans who had the virus with those who didn't. And in that report, Perlstein calls this decision utterly baffling and the opposite of infection control. And Attorney General Maura Healey also ran her own investigation. I think that's worth pointing out. And the big outcome from that was that she brought criminal charges against the former superintendent, Bennett Walsh, and the former medical director, David Clinton. So the outcome of that still remains to be seen. Yeah.
All right. So that remains to be seen. Where do things stand now overall?
Sure. So in the last year, the home tragically has lost 77 residents to COVID-19. And according to the latest information from the state, pretty much all residents have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Most have actually had both. And most staff are also vaccinated. The state is currently searching for a new superintendent for the home. And earlier today, I talked to the union rep that represents many of the employees. And he said that staff are very anxiously awaiting that decision. They're hoping that whoever is chosen is warm and personable and is open to hearing their opinions and getting their feedback, because that was something that the previous administration was not known for. And I think we have a bit of that conversation with the union rep. His name is Corey Bumbrady.
It was constant. It was always scary. Our members were always exposed. We had 34 of our members leave employment for various reasons, all COVID-related, from April 1st, 2020 to the beginning of March 2021.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, as you can hear in Corey's voice, like, this whole past year has been so traumatic for staff who were there through this whole ordeal. And Corey also told me that he's concerned that the facility is still short-staffed and that a lot of members are still, or a lot of his members, a lot of the employees there, are still really struggling with trauma.
So we have family members too, Miriam. Our producer, Paris Alston, spoke with Cheryl Melendrinos, who is the daughter-in-law of Harry Melendrinos, who died in the home at age 89. Here's what Cheryl said.
When he wasn't here for his 90th birthday in September, that was hard. Thanksgiving and Christmas, they were hard. Knowing that if better infection control procedures were in place sooner, it makes you kind of sad and angry all at once. Because you wonder, like, would Harry still be here?
It's painful, Miriam. What are you hearing about the longer-term impact on the families who were affected by this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what these families went through is just awful. And I've talked to Cheryl many times in the last year, and she is a true advocate for reforming this home. I remember really early on, one of the first stories I did about this after this whole story broke open was about the lack of communication between the facility's leadership and families. So people were watching the news and seeing all of this terrible stuff about the virus just wreaking havoc on the home. And they couldn't even get through to a nurse on the floor to check in on their loved ones. Luckily, that improved relatively quickly. But it was awful for everyone involved early on. I will say, to end on a more positive note, I do think that one of the good things that came out of this was maybe the way that families bonded together. There's a really strong Facebook group of people, and they console each other and also work on advocacy projects. So they're pushing the state to build a new soldiers' home, a new facility. They're advocating for accountability, and they're really doing what they can to keep the pressure up. And I don't think they're going to let what happened be forgotten.
Well, that is WBUR's Miriam Wasser on this one-year anniversary of the outbreak at the Holyoke Soldiers' Home. Miriam, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So the CDC director's in town. It's the one-year anniversary of the COVID-19 outbreak at the state-run Holyoke Soldiers' Home. The pandemic is on our minds here in the Commonwealth, so let's keep our focus there and answer your questions. Any you might have about vaccines, the rollout, reopening, what to expect moving forward over these next few weeks and months. It is time for Ask the Doctors. And you can call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two doctors joining us. Dr. Shira Durone is an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. And Dr. Joshua Barocas is an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University, School of Medicine. Dr. Durone, welcome.
Great to be back.
Dr. Barocas, great to have you back too.
Thanks for having me, as always.
So, Dr. Daron, let me start with you and get your responses to what we heard a little earlier in the show. Dr. Walensky at the Heinz Convention Center today, not calling out the Commonwealth, but also saying yesterday that she's worried we could be headed toward doom.
Well, I can't say I'm not worried. We had been seeing this precipitous drop in cases really throughout the entire country in January and February. We didn't really understand why that was happening. So by the same token, now that we're seeing rises in some parts of the country, but not others, it's really baffling, I think, that this virus continues to humble us because we don't really understand why this is happening right now.
So Dr. Daron, I guess I'm a little surprised to hear that even at this stage a year later, when we see things go down and we see them go up, we don't really know why.
Yeah, I mean, we think that we understand the association between human behavior and rising cases, but we also have these factors that are sort of coming to light of perhaps seasonality, perhaps some level of community immunity. And we thought all those things were perhaps at play when the numbers started to fall so drastically in January and February. The fact that they're turning a corner and going back upward only in certain parts of the country really tells us, you know, it's never quite as clear as it appears to be. Here you have states that have dropped mask mandates and opened wide up, like Texas, not experiencing increases in cases. And you have the Northeast, where we think we've been pretty good and well-behaved for an entire year now with cases rising. It's disheartening.
So Dr. Barocas, how do we then tell people what to do to stay on track when nationally we look at this data, just as Dr. Daron was just saying, and things seem to be sort of in backward world?
Yeah, I look at it. It's funny that you mentioned backward world. As Dr. Daron was talking, I was imagining one of those bouncy balls sort of hitting every wall of a room, just bouncing every which way. And that's sort of, I think, how most people feel these days, is their attention is being pulled one way or the other. You know, I know that it's we end up sounding like broken records, right? And that what we're asking for is some consistency. I think we've seen that when we have consistent policies in a region or in a state or in a country or in the country, then we do start to see some leveling out. You know, the viruses don't always follow the nice patterns that, or temporal patterns, or we don't necessarily see the patterns right away, which is why so many of us have, you know, whether on this show or on many others, have tried to maintain a consistent, unified message of the same mitigation techniques, same mitigation methods that we've been preaching for a year, simply because so much of this is a little bit unpredictable. So if we can take one of those unpredictable things out of the equation, then maybe we get to some more predictability.
Well, our callers are ready, so let's go to the phones here, 800-423-8255, to ask Drs. Daron and Barocas your questions. We'll start with Alex, who's in Northborough. Alex, go ahead.
Hi. My question is that I'm fully vaccinated. My husband's fully vaccinated, and our 12-year-old son just tested positive for COVID. When the health department contacted us, we were told we did not have to quarantine. But my question is, how likely are we to transmit COVID if we ourselves end up being positive, given that we both are at least 2 weeks past our vaccination times?
Dr. Daron, can I give that to you, please?
Sure. So congratulations on being fully vaccinated and maximally immune. Now, you know that no vaccine is perfect, but the vaccines that we have, we are so lucky because they're extremely effective. And the storybook is finally clear that the vaccines are very effective at both preventing symptomatic disease and asymptomatic sort of carrier state. You can feel pretty confident in your vaccine. Now, nothing was ever 100% when it came to quarantine. The CDC had dropped the requirement to 7 days with a test. That wasn't perfect in preventing someone from going out at the end of quarantine and infecting other people. And the vaccine isn't perfect, but it's pretty darn good. And I think you can feel confident both taking care of your son and then going out in the world, of course, with excellent masking, distancing, and all of those other precautions that you're probably very good at by now.
Let's pick up another call at 800-423-8255. We've got Teddy on the line in Medford. Teddy, what's your question?
Yes, my question is, my kids are going to go back to full school starting next week, next Monday. What should I worry about as a parent watching the case increase over the past couple of weeks and with the change to the new variant? What should I be concerned about and what should I be looking out for?
Thanks, Teddy. Dr. Barocas.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that your child is headed back to school. I know that many kids around the Commonwealth are excited about that. And I know that many teachers are as well. I think that a couple things, most, if not all of the schools and school districts around the state are following fairly good guidelines as far as distancing, time without masks, and all of the things that we've been doing as a society for the last year. To look out for, you know, I think that we want to make sure that your child or anyone's child isn't exhibiting any symptoms that might be classic for a symptomatic infection at this point. So sore throat, runny nose, fevers, feeling just muscle aches, body aches. And this can get a little bit tricky right now because we are also headed into allergy season.
Right.
So we want to make sure that if symptoms happen to be popping up, you're doing a good job at alerting the schools, the school district, and they should have a protocol in place. On the way home, it's always good, you know, that we always talk about the car ride being or the backseat conversations where kids tell us they're some of the stuff that we wouldn't otherwise hear. So just be on the lookout for what your child is telling you in between breaths. Sometimes they'll mention that, you know, I noticed that so-and-so next to me was coughing a lot today. That's one of those cases where you might just want to send the teacher an email and double check or figure out what's going on. I think that all of us are remaining fairly vigilant, and especially when kids come into play, we want to make sure that nobody's having symptoms. That's our best defense right now, and that they have excellent masking, that your kids know how to keep that mask over both nostrils and a mouth.
So I'm going to go back to the phones in a minute, but before I do, Dr. Durone, I want to come back to you for a second. With our previous caller, you congratulated them on having such an effective vaccine, and I want to ask you a question there. The CDC has a new study out that showed that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines were 90% effective at preventing infections in a study that was, rather than clinical trial settings, sort of an everyday settings. And that included infections that had no symptoms. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the implications of those findings. And can you tell us whether that setting this time around included exposure to the variants? Because I know the earlier clinical trials, the thought was perhaps Moderna and Pfizer might be a little less effective than how they showed in clinical trials because they really weren't introduced in the context of the variants.
So, you know, the study that was published by the CDC is actually one of many studies that have come out really in the past month that show both experimental and real world success of the vaccines in preventing asymptomatic infection. We have real world data from Israel, which is way ahead of us in terms of vaccinating a high proportion of the population, where they have 90% B117 variant that originated in the UK, showing prevention of asymptomatic infection as well as symptomatic infection. I think that it's pretty clear that the vaccines that we have are very effective against the B117 variant. The concern is the South Africa variant, and the vaccines are going to be somewhat less effective. So they're still going to be very effective against at preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and death. They would probably be less effective, although we don't have data specifically on this, against mild disease and therefore less effective against asymptomatic disease and silent carriage.
All right, you are listening to Ask the Doctors here on Radio Boston. The number to ask your question is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ray is on the line from Avon. Ray, what's your question?
My question was, I got the Moderna shot. I got both of them now, and the last one a couple of weeks ago. And then I heard on the radio this morning, the protection on these shots is up to 3 months. And I'm like, 3 months? When do I have to get another shot in 3 months? Do they have any idea how long that I'm protected for? Is it longer than 3 months? That's a
good question, Ray. Dr. Barocas, can you help us with that one?
Yeah, and before I do, I'm going to add to Dr. Daron's congratulations and also a thank you. And I think that everyone that is getting vaccinated, thank you for getting those two shots in the case of Pfizer and Moderna, and the one shot in the case of Johnson & Johnson. I think everyone deserves a lot of praise to get that. Now, as far as the 3 months, all of that is because that's how long the data that we have exists for. You know, when we look at how long immunity lasts for things like our measles shots, it's part of that is because we've had measles shots for so long that we've been able to figure out how long people have protection from that shot. We are still in the learning phase of the vaccine phase of this pandemic. Remember that this coronavirus popped up just a little bit over a year ago here in the United States. The vaccines were, while we started testing them mid-year, we really only have about 3 months. The clinical trials really only lasted for about 3 months in the later phases. And so all of that is based on the best knowledge that we have to date. Now, would I be surprised if in, you know, a few months we say, oh, good, your immunity lasts longer than 3 months? I would not be surprised. But right now, we're trying to do this. We're trying to message using a data-driven approach. And the data that we have say that our vaccines are effective for at least 3 months, and we will continue to evaluate the data longer.
Okay, so the message is not only 3 months. It's that we know definitively at this point 3 months, and hopefully as we
at
go
least,
longer,
yeah, I like we'll I like to use the at least. We know that it's good at for least. At least 3 months. We're looking forward to data that shows us longer.
Yes,
the CDC and the Mass DPH quietly took that 3 month limit off of their quarantine rules, so that the limit is no longer listed on the website.
All right, good to know. Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255 to ask your question. Carol's on the line from Mansfield. Carol, what's your question?
My question is that both my husband and I had the coronavirus. 4 days later, we got the monoclonal antibodies, and that was about 60 days ago. Now, I was able to sign up and get a shot, which would be about 62 days after the virus, and I know they say we should wait for 90. My second shot would be a little bit over 90 days. Am I wise in getting the shot that I signed up for on this coming Saturday, which would be about 62 days since the antibodies?
Carol, I'm glad you're okay. Which doctor would like to answer Carol's question?
Well, I can try. You know, the recommendation is that if you've had monoclonal antibody, you should wait 90 days before you get a COVID-19 vaccine. And again, this is a sort of expert opinion, kind of a data-free zone. But the concern is that the monoclonal antibody infusion could prevent your body from making the appropriate immune response to the vaccine. Now, you've already got some of your own natural immunity that it has built as a result of the infection. So it's not clear whether having gotten it earlier than 60 days is an actual would result in sort of actual decreasing of your immune response to the vaccine. It's not recommended, but it's probably okay.
So Dr. Barocas, Dr. Daron there was just talking to Carol about her natural immunity from having had COVID-19. And I want to ask a question. It's a little bit of an awkward question, but I think it's out there. So we now have, we continue to have, you know, between 50 and 60,000 cases in the United States a day. We know that here in the Commonwealth, the fastest growing rates of cases are among younger people. It is bad, but also less deadly for younger people than older adults who are increasingly being vaccinated in the Commonwealth. Where is our monitoring of herd immunity through both vaccination, but also people who are developing natural immunity from being exposed to the virus? And how do we put all of that into context?
That's a great question. So I think that there are a few components, two to three components that I want to keep in mind. The first is we have been talking about the idea of herd immunity, which for many of the listeners, it means that level of immunity in a population where we are effectively able to eliminate a disease or a virus in this case, because so many people have either been vaccinated or have natural immunity because they've been infected and survived, that it effectively protects the rest of the population that perhaps hasn't been infected or vaccinated. We are beginning this discussion of, will we actually reach herd immunity, or will we have some amount of, will this become an endemic virus where we sort of learn to live with it? And much like we do the seasonal influenza, a number of factors are at play here. The first is what we consider the herd. And right now, I think we have all started to realize, at least in the public health world, that since we're all connected, you know, via planes, you know, what happens in the United States and boats and whatnot, what happens in the United States is not solely within the United States. So we really, to really achieve a good herd immunity level, we have to think beyond our own borders. The other component is, in order to really reach that 70%, which, or the 60 to 70% herd immunity that many of us have tossed around for the last year, that's going to include getting younger people vaccinated. So we are still a bit away from that, simply because younger children, 16 and younger, aren't actually eligible for the vaccine. That's not to be the skunk at the party. I think that it's very possible that we might, in fact, end up hitting that 65-70%, at least in the United States. But I do want to encourage everyone that this goes beyond our own borders, and what happens globally affects us locally as well.
Well, I want to point out that neither of you is ever a skunk at the party, especially for coming so generously over and over again to answer our questions. Listeners, we're not going to get to more calls today, but as usual, we will do this again. For now, I want to thank, that was Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, as well as Dr. Shira Daron, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Daron, Dr. Barocas, thanks so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
There is no doubt this pandemic year has taken a toll on our mental health. We have seen Isolation, anxiety, fear, all spike. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 4 out of 10 adults have reported symptoms of anxiety or depressive disorder during the pandemic. That's compared to 1 in 10 the previous year. And for young adults ages 18 to 24, it's even higher. It's 56%. Our next guests believe that it's crucial to engage in an ongoing dialogue around mental health, and they use sports as a way to do that. Joining me now on the line are Jotham Busfield and John Cuna, both licensed therapists and co-hosts of the Grim Drive podcast. John, Jotham, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. And listen, for the listeners, I want to note at the top, this is going to be a discussion about both mental health and mental illness that can bring up trauma for listeners. So we want to put a key resource out for you right up front. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number is 1-800-273-8255. You can also use the crisis text line. You text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. Okay, John, Jotham, I want to start by asking you both what led to this podcast. Who are you trying to reach with it? What made you decide to do it? Either of you can just jump in.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, the collective mental health situation is not great right now. And I think that was probably trending in the wrong direction even before the pandemic. The pandemic has worsened those numbers, you know, to another degree, which is understandable. And John and I were just looking for what, you know, free ways to help more people. You know, we were both licensed clinicians. We own a company called Riser and Tread, where we do therapy and coaching in Greater Boston. And, you know, that work is fantastic. We're passionate about it, but it's also, you're limited to doing work one-on-one. So we were looking for ways, how can we reach more people and help more people? And that started with YouTube videos. We had some parents that asked us to do some targeted topics on YouTube videos related to like sleep health, hygiene, video game use, purpose development. We also did one on how to talk to your kids about mental health and when to, you know, learn how to reach out for help. So that's kind of what started it. Once we had those YouTube videos, John and I discussed, all right, how can we take this to the next level? How can we reach more people? And that, you know, made podcast the obvious choice. You know, we decided to create a podcast where we can post that on podcast platforms. We can post on YouTube. More people can access this helpful information. And ultimately, that's what led us to kind of come up with the idea. And I think, you know, we work with a lot of athletes. And, you know, ultimately, there's a lot of athletes coming forward.
Oh, I think we lost Jotham for a second there. I think he was going to say, John, that there are a lot of athletes coming forward.
To discuss mental health.
There we go. Jotham, do we have you back?
Can you hear me now?
I can, Jotham. So I think you were saying there are more athletes coming forward in social media to talk about mental health. Is that right?
Absolutely. There's a huge tipping point right now with more and more athletes coming forward to discuss their mental health journeys. You know, we've covered a few of them, obviously, in the podcast. I think it started with, you know, Meta World Peace in 2010, thanks to a psychiatrist after the Lakers won the championship. You know, Brandon Marshall is a former NFL player who talked about his mental health in 2011. And since then, Shamiqua Holdsclaw came out in 2017 about her experience. And then we saw our first two episodes covered DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love, who are two active NBA players who talked about their mental health experience. So the stigma has never been lower. And these athletes are driving that, in my opinion. And we thought it was important to shine a light on those athletes and encourage listeners to take that first step. You know, opening up about mental health is hard. It takes a different type of strength, you know, strength through vulnerability. And listening and learning about a high-profile athlete's experience is a much easier step for some people. And, you know, we want to encourage listeners to take that first step.
So, John, talk a little bit more about that. How do you make the connection between the experience that the athlete is speaking of, often a professional athlete, and what individuals, families, parents, young adults can and are encouraged to do or might want to do as first steps in their own lives?
Yeah, I think the work that we do, I think it makes it more accessible. And that threshold that Jotham was talking about, the stigma, a little bit lower. So when people are seeing these top tier athletes come out and talk about depressive symptoms or anxiety or their own struggles with, you know, ADHD or things like that, the relatability is there. And so for us to be able to mimic language or borrow from experiences from others who are strong advocates in the field, it makes it easier for people to come to the conversation, especially for athletes. I think there's been, and for male athletes especially too, there's this huge stigma around, you know, what it means to be a man, and we can't talk about these things. And then we see more people coming out and talking about these things. And so for us to be able to capitalize on that moment, I think provides a really unique opportunity for us to talk about some real issues, and have people who are already looking up to Kevin Love, or Michael Phelps is a pretty outspoken person as well, for us to be able to use those platforms as a gateway in to talk about some real things for people. And I think that that's where athletics really lends itself to an easy transition to the conversation. A lot of the skills, a lot of the things that are talked about in sports are really helpful information for people to gather. And I think that we have, you know, borrowing that language and taking from experiences from others, I think it's really, really helpful. And we've seen a huge increase with people coming and talking, and huge influx with athletes coming and wanting to learn more about these things, I think because the times are shifting. But I also think that we're speaking a language that athletes are understanding. And for parents as well, I think it provides good structure and form and information for them to borrow so that they can help to support their kids as well.
So, Jotham, what are some of the issues you have been talking about in the Grim Drive that you've heard from listeners they most connect with?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think our format tends to be, you know, each episode has one athlete and one mental health topic. So we try to find, you know, with regard to the topic, we try to find a blend of topics. You know, we cover three kind of areas in general: mental fitness, mental health, and mental illness. So we consider those all sort of under the mental health umbrella, and we don't want to focus on one more than the other and leave one out. So we cover mental fitness, mental health, and mental illness, and we really try to balance that out in terms of the topic. And then with regard to athletes, you know, we try to find the athletes who have spoken up about their mental health and really been vocal about their journey, because, you know, we think it's important to shine a light on that first and foremost. And then also we'd rather focus on athletes who have come forward and talk, you know, been open about their mental health, than maybe focus on athletes who haven't done that yet, because we don't want to speculate, and we're not exactly sure if they want that spotlight on them.
So, John, you know, I've been thinking about the fact that this last year sports has actually been something people have lost, especially young people. We talked, I want to play a little sound for you. We talked to Needham High School soccer coach Carl Tarabelli in October. And at the end of our conversation, I had asked him what he hopes sports starting to come back for kids could mean. His answer was striking. Here's part of what he said.
This has to represent some sense of normalcy. The fact that they know after school, whether it's remote, whether it's hybrid, whether it's, you know, in school, that they have a structure that they've always had. They can go down to the field after school, be with their friends, train, turn off all the craziness that's been surrounding them for at least 2 hours, and let them be kids again. That's the most important thing.
So here we have sports as a key piece of normalcy, a loss of that normalcy over the last year. And then I'm thinking about the Dak Prescott episode about recovery, where you talk about the fact that we don't then address the trauma of loss. We address the physical parts. So, I mean, that's all bound up in a lot of loss for kids of their normalcy and their outlets right now. Do you talk about that? Are you hearing about that? What's your response to that?
Yeah, it's a great point and topic. And I think it's one that Jotham and I are really trying to have more of. And so, you know, I think what the coach was talking about is so true. I think loss of structure for kids has been huge. I think that the thing that I noticed the most is for a lot of these kids, their sport is one of their primary senses of joy, and that's been removed. Mm-hmm. A lot of people sort of leaning on joy and structure for coping through just general anxiety, and then layer on an enormous stressor, the pandemic, and then remove the thing that might be their most, you know, their most important sense of self, identity, and coping. And it sort of is a perfect storm. I think what it really highlights, and a lot of the work that we do through the recovery program, is talking about that loss of identity. And almost, it sort of resembles grief work in a way. You know, we tend to focus more on athletes who are going through like physical injury and they're removed from the sport. But there is a sense of almost depressive symptoms that come from that, because their identity is sort of removed. And I think one of the things that I see quite frequently in working with athletes is that are going through recovery is that their primary sense of self and identity comes from their performance on the rink, field, court. And then to remove that, who am I? What am I? You know, all of my work, all of my energy has been devoted for this purpose, and now it's been removed. What do I do?
And so a lot of the work that we do, that we, you know, we talk more about this in the Dak Prescott episode, but a lot of the work that we do is to try to develop other sources of strength and pillars of identity outside of just their performance. And when you tie your identity so closely to your performance, it's not, performance isn't always completely controllable. And you really want to be driving confidence and what we call cultivating confidence from other areas. You are not just a performer. You are a student. You are, you know, and you kind of go through all of these other parts and components of who you are that you have control over cultivating to generate confidence from. And that work has spiked dramatically since the pandemic and the removal of, like I said, this sense of identity and joy. And to your point, which is a great one, it does resemble a lot of loss and grief work that we have to go. It's almost like you're grieving the loss of this part of you in the meantime, while we're trying to get back to some sense of structure. And it is an interesting conversation, and it's one that we're thankful to be having more now, because I think it's really important, and it's a really big hole in what we see with recovering athletes. And, you know, our goal is really that when an athlete at pro level, high school level, really any level, is going through some form of injury or recovery, that working with a mental health professional is just a part of it. You know, there's no issue if you sprain your ankle to go to talk to a physical therapist, but there's no same normalcy of going and talking to someone to help repair the mind that might be going through something pretty traumatic. And I think that when I look at recovery, I see the whole body, the whole person, not just the ailment of the, you know, broken leg, torn ankle. I see a little bit more of a holistic approach as being a more efficient way to bring somebody back.
So Jotham, in our last minute or so, and I am mindful of time, but I'm listening to John and talking about this performance orientation and building a larger sense of self. It strikes me that easily translates to our culture of achievement for all kinds of young people, whether it's grades or SAT scores, or, you know, you have to do 52 activities. In addition to sports, there are broader lessons here, yes?
Absolutely. I think that's where the title of the podcast kind of comes from. The, you know, Grim Drive is something that we use as sort of a, it's kind of a, you know, humorous, but also cautionary motto. You know, I think we use it as a motto, John and I, kind of jokingly, to keep things light and to remind us about the importance of, like, the relentless pursuit of purpose-driven goals and pushing through adversity, right? Because when you're pushing through adversity, things can get pretty grim and you have to be able to drive through and push through. It's also a cautionary motto because there's a very fine line between dedication and workaholism. You know, John and I, you know, own a business together, and we know from building that business that it's hard. You have to work a lot of hours, but we prioritize mental fitness and self-care and balance, you know, balance through our family, balance through our friends, things like that. They're going to keep us centered and in a good place. And I think, you know, we see young athletes and young students around here really struggle with that balance because they're pushed to achieve. And a lot of the athletes we've focused on in these episodes have also struggled to find that line.
Wow. I really appreciate
just to
this.
Add,
yeah, go ahead quickly.
Just one last point about just a lot of the lessons you learn from athletics also very much apply to real world. And I think that's one of the benefits of the program that we do, is that it lends itself to that transition.
That is John Cuna and Jotham Busfield, licensed therapists and co-hosts of the Grim Drive podcast. Great conversation. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
And again, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 800-273-8255, or text the crisis line, text HOME to 741-741. That is our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.